This week on Lunchbox Envy, there's an underwater one in Norway,
a volcano-powered one in Spain,
and a toilet-themed one in Taiwan.
It's restaurants! Rawr! Hello and welcome to Lunchbox Envy. I'm Alex and I'm here with my fellow QILs, my fellow diners, Jack and Manu.
Hello!
Excited for some fancy plates today. Oh. So what defines a restaurant?
So it's an eating house establishment where meals are brought and eaten on the premises.
Bought and eaten or brought?
Bought.
Bought.
You pay money at a place and then you eat the food that you've just bought at that place.
Okay, but there are lots of things that I would say aren't restaurants that fit that description.
Yeah, what, like a street food van?
Yeah. I asked whether it was bought or brought because there is a long history of like eating houses and inns and taverns and things which are the precursors to restaurants where you would bring your own food and then they would prepare it for you and like eat it up. So like that was a stage of public eating.
That's
before
so
the restaurant.
Cool.
I would say that. I had a few things that distinguishes it from a cafe or a food stall or, you know, a cafeteria or whatever. Customers arrive primarily to eat. They can choose from a range of dishes.
Okay, yeah.
The prices are known in advance. They're listed. Food is prepared to order. That's quite an important thing, I think.
Yeah.
And individual parties receive separate tables and service.
Wait, so is a buffet restaurant then not a restaurant because it's not prepared to order?
It's actually a berry. I didn't really look for a technical answer so much as what you feel is a restaurant. Like, does the food quality... I think the food quality has to be higher than you can cook at home, which makes the definition very different if you're a bad cook if you're a professional chef.
Maybe it's an occasion. Like, the fact that you're going out on an occasion, because even if you go and eat in a cafe or a Pret or whatever, that's not an occasion. You're just going there to eat food, even though it takes all the time.
Don't you read about like people like Noel Coward, who spent like a year living in the Savoy, and so he'd eat at a restaurant every single meal.
Yeah, well, there's always people who are going to break every rule.
I know.
Oh, here's another one. How do you feel about eating on your own in restaurants?
I used to do it all the time.
I feel like that's another big thing. Like, restaurants, it's an occasion. It's also, for me, a sociable thing.
Yeah.
Like, you go with people.
I see.
You're celebrating the food. You're not cooking any of it. You're not hosting, so you actually have time to talk and eat.
Yeah.
I think that's a big part for me. I did have one more big question.
Mm.
How are we pronouncing this word?
Restaurant.
Oh, that's pretty good, isn't it?
Because it's like there's a spectrum of pronunciation.
Mm.
I usually use champagne as an example. We say champagne in England.
Mm-hmm.
We don't say champagne.
Mm-hmm.
Mm.
But then you also don't say champagne. So I would say restaurant.
Cappenero.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah.
That's so true, actually. Champagne is a mix of both, isn't it?
Yeah, so we say restaurant, I think, which is a bit of a combination.
Restaurant.
I don't say the R.
Yeah.
I don't say the R.
The syllables, the number of syllables and the way you pronounce it kind of differentiate.
Is it two or three?
Yeah, it's two or three, and it differentiates between the English, like British English and American English.
Apparently
in British English, we tend to say restaurant or restaurant.
Like, three syllables.
Yeah.
It's kind of anglicized, but there's three. And then the Americans do restaurant.
Restaurant.
Yeah.
But we also don't say pavement.
No, exactly.
And they say sidewalk.
The French have so many different, again, it's really hard to pin down, but there's the brasserie, which is a cozy eatery.
Oh, wait, I know that one.
Oh, go on then.
That means brewery, right?
Yeah, yeah. So it's where the beer's brewed on site. There's the bistro.
Yes, that etymology is a bit murky. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So the bistro is a kind of Parisian slang term for little wine shop. But the etymology, like we said, is quite murky. But the biggest difference between a brasserie and a bistro is that the bistro closes between lunch and dinner.
Oh,
and the brasserie stays open. And then my favourite, which I didn't know was a thing until last year, the bouchon. Which is specific to Lyon.
To Lyon,
Oh, what
and
is
it's,
that?
It's like a bistro, so it's very casual, and it serves like traditional Lyonnaise foods.
One of the things that defines a Lyon bouchon is the Czech tablecloth.
Mm.
Did
you read that?
That's like a real classic. That's like a restaurant cliche. Mm-hmm. It's like a Czech tablecloth, yeah.
And then there's another one I've never heard of, which is estaminet.
Estaminet, only in passing.
Yeah, it's like a northern French kind of Flemish one. That, apparently their speciality is cooking meats and stuff that are really locally produced. But
classic France to have four different words for restaurants. Like the thing you might have 47 words for snow, and the French have 47 words for restaurant, including restaurant.
On the word restaurant, it's hard to verify, but I read that it is, or at least used to be, one of the words that people most often Google to find out how to spell.
I see.
I think it's like that's the most tricky. It's the most common difficult word.
Americans think there are two syllables.
Oh, yeah. Restaurant.
What are all these
necessary
extra vowels?
For me, I still cannot spell that word.
Have you heard of Restaurant Day?
No,
what is that?
So this was something that started in Helsinki in Finland in 2011. I don't really think it's still going on that much in a formal way, which is a bit sad. I think it's died out a bit, but we should definitely bring it back. They used to do it like quarterly, so once every 3 months.
Wow.
And the idea was that like for a day, anyone could set up a pop-up restaurant or a cafe or a bar, like anywhere. So like on your rooftop or in a cafe, on the street corner.
I'm smelling lawsuits here.
Yeah, I was going to say health and safety, hygiene licenses.
Well, that's the thing. These things are all suspended. I think so. And I think that's the understanding is that, like, I guess you go and do so at your own risk. But in the same way that, like, I guess a bring and buy sale probably isn't a licensed premises.
It's
like a community event.
Yeah.
And it started in Helsinki. I think it spread around the world, and there were quite a lot of organised places that did this.
I think we've got such a culture of like health and safety in this country. We can't imagine anything being 100%. At all unregulated.
Also, I've heard so many horror stories recently. So a friend of a friend of a friend of mine works in a restaurant that is directly next to another very famous restaurant.
Ooh.
And apparently the hygiene rating is awful. Like, they've scored so low.
Oh, they've actually got an official low hygiene
rating.
Do they have to put it in the window?
I think they must do.
Yeah, in Britain, every single restaurant and cafe has a green sticker with a rating or a hygiene rating out of 5.
Like somewhere near the entrance or
something.
Yeah,
basically.
Usually.
So I reckon 80% of ones have 5.
Which is the best.
Which is the best, yeah. And about 19 of the remaining 20% have 4.
Yeah.
Occasionally you see one with a 3.
And
I remember being a student in Sheffield, and this place is shut down now, so it's all fine. But they were sort of serving curries out of what it was like a terraced house. So it didn't look that different. It had a big sign though. And we looked them up, and they had a 0-star hygiene.
Oh my God.
They didn't even have 1.
That's crazy.
Surely you can't be open.
They give you like 3 to 6 months to sort it out.
That's such a long time as well. Like, I don't understand. Like, imagine knowing that the next day after you give out that hygiene rating, people are going to go and eat there. And you're like, well, there's no chance they've improved any of it.
They're doing delicious Bangladeshi curries.
Oh, Jack went there every day after that. They should be able to flash a badge and like kind of rage. Come down from the skylight.
Like, so his guns have just got like spray cans.
Death hole everywhere.
Another kitchen, a friend of a friend of a friend, they were making sausages illegally in their restaurant, and they had like a secret room full of their sausages just hidden behind like a load of
high strength.
I'm imagining like that episode of Breaking Bad where they go under the laundrette and have this amazing lab where they're making meth, but just all sausages.
They blew sausages.
So they were like selling them as like a side hustle.
Yeah, well, no, it was like they were putting them on their menu, but I think you need like a special license or some
to
kind
make
of
sausages.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Some botulism. Wow. Everyone was fine.
I feel like we've opened this in like a really disgusting way. I was hoping this would be a really nice and classy episode. But
how often do you go to restaurants? Because it has really suffered, I think, certainly in London with rising prices.
It's tough. It's expensive. Yeah.
I read in a Guardian report, London restaurants basically break down the cost of a dish and where all that money goes. Because obviously people will see, I don't know, like bread and butter for £5. And they're like, this is crazy. Yeah. You can buy bread for £1 or whatever. Mm. But they spend so much money on rent.
Yeah.
That's the biggest cost, I
rent
think.
Rent, utilities, tax are like
wages,
all this. That's the thing that's
water
causing
bills,
the problem. Yeah.
And obviously, utilities go up for everyone, but they've got utilities as well as rent and staff and the employer's insurance and stuff. And weird things like they pay council tax, but they also have to pay for private waste removal.
It's such a big thing. Also, their laundry is insane.
One example they put in the Guardian, they had beef sirloin short rib with wild garlic, cost £36 to the diner before service, makes just 44p in profit. So they're on really tight. I mean, obviously, I think restaurant eating should be an expense and a celebratory thing. You shouldn't be able
luxury,
to afford it all the time, but I do encourage you to go and
support your local eateries. Thing that really makes
use
my heart ache is that, and like, it would stress me out the most about running a restaurant, that ineffable thing where some days, evenings, you walk past a restaurant and it's just empty and the owner's just standing outside, and it's just because need a couple of people in there
the
for the restaurant
effect.
Not to look awful.
You need a snowball effect.
And then all of a sudden everyone will go and then suddenly it's full. But like every day you've got that challenge of, what if no one walks through the door? And then everyone looks at our restaurant and it looks empty, so nobody wants to walk through the door, so they go next door instead. Like, terrifying. Yeah.
Do you think think that's a job. People employ people to just come and sit.
Be the first.
Yeah. It's like, you know, you never want to be the first at a party.
Yeah, yeah.
That is that horrible moment. I'd happily earn money just sitting in.
If that is a job, this podcast is ending today. Yeah. And we're all getting doing that. Maybe what they should do is they should like Home Alone it and have like mannequins and stuff like silhouetted in the windows having a good time. And then people come in and be like, oh,
that's a really good robot. Idea. Yeah. Too late now. It's a starter.
Okay, on to our first course then, and that is Jax.
Okay, guys, for your starter, I brought you a hot cup of restorative broth.
Ooh. Is that copper soup, basically?
Yeah, basically.
It's really nice.
And how much are you going to be charging us for that?
This will be $44.99. So this broth is why we have the word restaurant. So I'm going to talk you through the history of communal dining, because it kind of evolved over thousands of years. But there is actually a point at which we can basically define what a restaurant is.
Ooh, okay. Nice.
Let me take you back to ancient times.
I thought you were going to start rapping. Yeah.
So the ancient Romans had things called thermopylae. And these were like bars that you could get served food if you couldn't be bothered to cook at home, or you might not have a kitchen, to be honest, because...
Yeah, most people just didn't have the ability to cook at home, right?
But we think they served quite simple fare, and they weren't occasions. You wouldn't go. Mm-hmm.
And they were like takeaway food as well. Yeah. It wasn't really a restaurant, but it was kind of like for...
Absolutely.
There was a lot of communal dining.
But you were like cooking food for strangers, basically. Mm-hmm. So then we fast forward to the Song Dynasty in China, which was 960 Common Era to 1279. Uh-huh. So, roughly 1,000 years ago.
11th,
but obviously like
centuries,
a couple of hundred years. And there are descriptions of what we would recognise as restaurants today, insofar as they had menus and people would go there as an occasion. And they were sort of wealthy civil servants. It wasn't available to everyone in the sort of middle or lower classes. Elite. It was quite elite. Chefs were called pot masters or controllers of the preparation table.
That'll bring that back. Yeah.
Controllers of the preparation tables.
My compliments to the controller of the preparation table.
but it was all about the spectacle. So they would sort of lay out quite a beautiful space and, you know, you'd sit there for a long amount of time. And basically the waiter would come and then you would order what you wanted. And then it was his job, and it was usually a man, to bring out up to 20 dishes all in one go, all stacked up, and put them down in the order that you ordered them in and recite them
like
all.
Like a memory game.
A bit like a memory game, yeah. So it was a bit kind of poetic and theatrical.
Uh-huh. It sounds like I could get one of those game shows from the 80s. Yeah, like, here's what you ordered. And then it all goes along and
Isn't there one of the most stressful like games you play online as a kid, like having your own kitchen?
Yeah.
Do you remember that? Yeah. And then it got faster and faster and faster, and it's just like everyone in the ICT room like... screaming.
And then you're sat out the back crying, having a smoke as a three-year-old. Like.
But yeah, they couldn't get anything wrong. Otherwise, they would like...
Be killed.
Not quite that extreme, but like in extreme cases, you lose your job. Because it was all about the spectacle. And it was so high-end because people were paying so much money.
I read somewhere that like, because there were these huge merchant towns, it was intra-cuisine. So it was people who traveled from another part of China who kind of like were looking to eat the food like it was home. So like, you kind of, all the early restaurants are kind of like ethnic restaurants, but within China.
Sorry, that's like when you go somewhere and you just eat Mackey's.
Yeah.
Like, you gotta mix it up.
It's traditional.
It's
doing what people have been doing for thousands of years. Yeah.
So then within the Middle Ages in Europe, you would get inns, sort of like pubs and hotels, but they'd be by the side of a road so you could rest your horses and rest your head for the night. And they would serve food, obviously, but they would serve whatever they were cooking at the time. So there wasn't any choice and it wasn't really an occasion. So we're sort of dancing around the concept here. And then...
But there are a lot of quite fancy restaurants today that do that. Yeah. Like, we're serving what we have on the menu today. It's one, you know, you have one set menu.
Have you guys heard of the Yellow Bittern?
No, what's that?
Well, it's,
I think you mentioned it there.
Yeah, it's only open weekday lunches.
Okay.
They have a set menu.
It's like the post office.
But no, it's like one of the most popular restaurants in London. Like, it's basically for people in hospitality who have odd days off and they can go and like spend a shit ton of money. It does it really fun.
So then the first restaurants proper are from 1750s Paris.
Yeah.
And there's a guy called Mathurin Rose de Chantoiseau.
Oh, beautiful name.
Chantoiseau means birdsong, doesn't it?
Mm. Oh, of course, that's such a French name.
Yeah. I know.
I imagine him as a Quentin Blake character.
Yeah, I can picture it now, yeah.
Big moustache. 1750s.
But yeah, so he made an establishment which served bouillon restaurant, which bouillon means restaurant. Restorative broth. And they were designed as sort of like health food places. Mm-hmm. So that's where you start getting individual tables so that you don't spread germs.
Yeah.
And you had menus, but we had them in Song Dynasty China. But you also had upfront prices, mm-hmm, and a choice of meals, uh-huh, and you could come in at any time. That was the other difference. So a lot of restaurants before were like,
it's like turning up for dinner at a,
yeah,
time.
We're serving, yeah, this at 4 p.m. be there, right, or be square, right? Uh-huh. So now you could turn up at like 2 p.m. mm-hmm, and be like, I want one of those. Mm. And they'd be like, okay, great.
And crucially, I guess, this is the use of the word restaurant, and we still call them restaurants.
Exactly.
So like, uh-huh, this has to be a bit of a monster.
That's the killer,
yeah,
bit. But he would serve like basically just broths and pudding, rice puddings, and you know, everything is porridge.
It's giving
because it was serving to like infirm people.
Yeah.
It was designed to be for the weak chested.
My immediate thought is enemas after all of the chat. I'm like, it's definitely going up someone's butt.
Imagine
as well
if the first restaurant didn't serve food, it served enemas.
I can 100%. There is definitely a section of society in London who would happily go to a really chic restaurant just called Enema, all lowercase, and all the food is served up your bar, and that's just the latest trend.
Yeah, they do really well.
The Nutribullet's at every table.
The Nutribullet just fills up, spins around, and then you see it go like that, and everyone goes.
I'm just thinking of the Nando's spice level for how like, how spicy you want to be.
Why do we have heat receptors there?
Yeah, so weird.
It makes no sense.
Yeah. But then yeah, it's we've been evolved waiting for an enema-based restaurant, clearly.
But yes, it was commonly thought there was a Monsieur Boulanger who invented the restaurant.
Okay, this is a thing that I read everywhere, and it's a myth.
It seems to be. So there's a common story that it was Monsieur Boulanger who invented basically exactly the same thing.
Another Quentin Blake character.
Yeah, basically. He would serve one dish, which, mm-hmm, was sheep's feet in white sauce.
Okay.
Wasn't there like a whole, he like took on the guilds?
Yes.
Because apparently like there were loads of laws in France about who could prepare certain hot foods, mm, and like each trade had protected dishes. And then with his sheep stew, he like took on the big guild, yeah, and won.
It was like McVitie's and the Jaffa Cake. Yeah. He had to like prove that his sheep's broth wasn't a proper meal or something.
Yeah.
But yeah, Rebecca Spang, the food historian, hasn't found any evidence of this man ever existing.
Oh. So it's a total myth.
Well, yeah, I think his name just got confused.
It's wow. Very
because
specific.
Mathieu Rosin de Chantoiseau definitely, yeah, existed. Yeah,
so kind of early restaurant-y culture was Chinese, really, mm-hmm, and Asian and Japanese. Mm-hmm. But like the first kind of restaurant as we know it, yeah, was French.
With the name restaurant.
With, mm-hmm, the name restaurant, but it wasn't Monsieur Boulanger, which people, mm-hmm, seem to think it was.
Absolutely not.
Okay.
So what's the date for the first restaurant as you described it?
1765.
Okay, because I was also looking into really old restaurants, mm, and the Guinness World Record holder for the, mm, oldest restaurant is in Madrid.
Yes.
Yes. So it's Sobrino de Botin.
But theirs is 1725, is the year that they say.
Yeah.
But I think I have an explanation for that, and that's because it evolved into a restaurant. It started out as an inn, mm, where people would bring food, so it wasn't really a proper restaurant.
Also, they're Spanish, they eat later in the day. That's, they probably opened in 1725.
1725 was the opening time.
But they're being given a run for their money by another restaurant in Madrid called Casa Pedro.
Wait, given a run for their money? Surely it's like, you can't overtake someone.
Well, they're really trying.
Yeah, there's always so many different claims.
Oh, I see. Like, oh, we were
And it's always a bit fuzzy when it's that far back. It's like, did you open first, or actually did you do this and then you were this and then,
and also triggers broom, like if it comes under different control and then they knock it down and rebuild, yeah, exactly, it, is it the same restaurant?
Yeah. It really sucks for them because they've got records up to 750. They hired a historian to 1750. All over their restaurants says 1702, like on the sign, they've like printed it everywhere. But because of the Civil War, loads of the records burnt down, so they're unable to like go further yet.
Interesting.
Again, you might uncover a tomb of someone who's like, I built the restaurant in 1750.
Oldest restaurant in the UK?
Oh, I didn't find
this one. You love this one. You know it.
Oh, no, I do.
Yeah. Wait, is this the one that was a few doors down from the LQI office?
I do know this one.
Yes. We've eaten there. I've eaten there.
Have you?
Yeah.
Was it good?
It was okay. it's a sort of very old school, musty, mm-hmm. everything's sort of covered in velvet.
Oh, yeah.
All the waiters were 150 years old. Mm-hmm. what I love about it is that, so it's on Maiden Lane, which is where the old QI office used to mm-hmm. be. So I can't historically dox yourself, can you? Rules is at one end of Maiden Lane. And at the other end is a really big red brick building, very mm-hmm. old building, which used to be a workhouse.
Oh, yeah.
And in Dickensian times, as they probably weren't known then, but like, came to be known, a child, Charles Dickens, was employed in the workhouse there as an impoverished kid. And then later in life, as a rich, successful publisher, he was a member of the mm. Rules Club, which is Ooh. On the floor above. And they know which seat he used to sit in. He used to have a favourite seat by the window. Wow. And if you sit there, you can see the workhouse. Wow. So he used to sit in the window and look at the workhouse.
Like, that's where I came from.
And I'm like, that's, he must have sat there being like, this is so Dickensian.
Wait, did he know the word Dickensian existed?
No, surely not.
I was like, wow, he's so forward thinking.
Living in the Onryo era.
Yeah. Oh, I'm really big at things.
But yeah, so just quickly from 1750s, mm. we have the written bill of fare. So basically you go in and you see the price list.
Yeah.
That was introduced in Vienna in the 1790s.
Right.
But they were called Gasthofer, so they weren't like restaurants. I think the restaurant proper comes from Paris. And part of the reason Paris was a hotbed for restaurants is because of the revolution. So in the 1790s, all the aristocracy, which had been had their heads chopped off, they all had private
all
chefs.
They'd left.
All they'd left, yeah. Yeah, yeah. They all had private chefs that were very well trained in making delicious food, and they had no one to cater for anymore. So they spread across Europe and the rest of France.
Oh, so they were all working in private houses.
And we're basically like, let's set up a restaurant. And then we can make money off
today's
our
special
skills.
Boiled head of my boss.
This is why we should kill more rich people.
Yeah.
It's genius.
We can take their chefs. Yeah. Yeah.
Eat the rich and it can be cooked by their staff.
So the early restaurants in Paris in the 1790s, they all had mirrored walls. And it's partly because...
For sex reasons.
Not sex reasons. But it's mostly because they were all about health consciousness. You could be seen to be eating, and you could like see your neighbors eating healthily. And I think this is like the precursor to everyone Instagramming their food. It's like,
wow, it's like live Instagram
cameras,
live. It's like live streaming
yeah,
yourself.
Exactly, live streaming.
That's what a mirror is. It's a live stream to yourself. So I don't understand. So like the logic behind that was what, like you can kind of revel in the fact that you're all being so healthy, and you're
yeah,
like, look
you
at us,
like,
look
at
me,
I'm
look
restoring
at you.
And... myself.
Wow. Do you like watching other people eat? It's,
I or mean, yourself. Do you want to watch yourself eat?
I don't want to watch myself eat.
Depends how my hair's looking. but mukbang exists. Surely
I
that
know,
was just.
No, but that. I don't know why that feels different.
There's a restaurant in Covent Garden called Balthazar's, which I think you've probably been to, which has big mirrors on the wall, but they are hung at a slight angle. So it looks like that scene in Inception, and it always makes me like really uncomfortable because like there's a whole other restaurant at a sort of 40-degree angle sliding towards you.
Although surely that is exactly like the kind of selfie Instagram, because everything's like from that 45-degree.
That's
down.
True. It's more flattering, actually.
Yeah, it's got
that's
true.
And maybe that's it. Everyone's a bit more contoured, and they're like, "Well, I will have dessert because I'm looking snatched today." Okay, on to our second course, and that is Manu's.
I wanted to start with a question, which is, if I ask you to imagine a chef, what are they wearing?
They've got four legs and a long tail that looks like a worm and lots of fur.
Okay, I don't know where you're eating, Jack.
A ratatouille restaurant.
Okay, I'm going to go. They've got the like a white coat, mm-hmm. and they've got checked trousers, mm-hmm. And a big tall white hat. Mm-hmm. They're doing
kiss.
The OK symbol, the chef's kiss.
Oh, beautiful.
And they've got a big wooden spoon.
Today, I have brought a toque.
Oh, cool.
Oh, not the kind of toque, like a hat. Just to be clear,
T-O-Q-U-E, right?
It is. A chef's hat.
Beautiful. Oh, that really suits you.
That does.
I love it. I'm actually very, very excited about this. I will pass it round. Don't worry.
You are literally passing the toque.
Yeah, I'm passing a toque round. Today, I wanted to talk about kitchen attire, kitchen culture, and my thesis that I wrote, is all about professional kitchens.
Your actual university thesis?
My actual master's ethnography. Wow. So this thing that I'm wearing on my head, the toque, there you go.
Which,
thank you.
For those who aren't...
It's the puffy white chef's hat that looks like a cake.
Yeah. Yes,
it's
exactly.
It's like a marshmallow.
Is it supposed to stand up tall? Or is it supposed to be like slid over like a beret?
It's a personal preference thing.
You're like a Smurf.
Basically, no one wears this anymore, apart from ceremonially. But this used to be kind of very standard fare for traditional French chefs. So the origins of this hat are pretty confusing because it's a very weird style. Mm. There's an idea that it was inspired by the crown-like hats that Assyrian chefs, so ancient Assyrian chefs, used to wear. Basically, monarchs at the time were really worried about getting poisoned. So whoever you employed as your chef, people to prepare you food, you really, really trusted them. Mm. So you gave them a special hat to wear. Like, I really trust you. Have a nice crown-looking hat and loads of money.
But there's so much space to hide things in, like a rat.
Yeah, it's a lot of space for poison, yeah.
So there's another kind of story that it's inspired by Greek Orthodox priests.
Oh, yeah.
I can see that.
It's very toky. They're normally in black, but they're a very similar shape. So there's an idea that chefs fleeing the Byzantine Empire fled to Greece, and they were saved by these Greek monks, and they kind of adopted the hat as a mark of respect. Okay. And it is fire. Like, it looks really good.
Yeah. It's a shame they've done that because it's a cool look.
It's really good. But the really tall chef's hat that I imagine when we think of chef was actually popularized by Marie Carême, who's the first celebrity chef we've spoken a lot about, who was really, really into like the kind of military style chef's hats that they were wearing in France at the time. But the way that they kind of used those hats to distinguish between different ranks of chefs was with colors. So you went into the kitchen, and depending on where you were in the kind of kitchen order, you'd have a different color hat. What he did, according to the story, is just made his super tall. So instead of different colors, you just had like the taller the hat, the higher up in the kitchen you are.
That's so dumb.
It's so silly. But Escoffier loved it. So this was another really famous French chef who was alive between 1846 and 1935. Mm-hmm. He was the one who brought the kind of military brigade system, so really strict hierarchy, into professional kitchens.
I'm just picturing like a full army in full regalia with a big marching band.
Like, have you seen the rest of their outfits? Like, they're very military. So they've got like the buttons, but he also loved this hat. So that's why it's kind of become enshrined in this like classical image of
Escoffier. Was quite influential in what we imagine as fine dining.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. He's like the fine dining chef.
Cool.
And then you have the pleats in the hat as well. So this is, again, the origins of this hat are really very murky, but there's an idea that for every pleat is like a culinary technique that you picked up. So if you have 100 pleats in your hat, you might know how to cook an egg like 100 different ways.
I've heard it specifically with eggs. It's like you've got 30 pleats, you've got 30 ways to cook an egg.
That's bullshit. Sorry, no way. Prove it.
You're
a chef? Boil 100 eggs.
But yeah, it's in my head, it is like the ultimate dick swinging contest in the kitchen of the time. You have a really big hat.
Yeah.
Very, very good at cooking. It's really interesting because there are so many elements of this kind of very militarized, very masculinized kitchen culture that have survived even today when there's like more and more women coming into kitchens. And this is something that I focused on loads in my thesis, which I brought with me. My thesis.
Beautiful. Oh, how many words?
26,061 words.
Wow.
So buckle in. So it's changing tastes, women and gender performance in London restaurant kitchens. So basically what I did was have this question about how women in food and the influx of female chefs, is it changing professional kitchen culture? Are they becoming a bit like quote unquote kinder and less like aggressive? And I went to three different kitchens in London, and it was so much more interesting and so much more complicated than I thought. But one of the things I really loved focusing on is how women kind of do femininity in kitchens, which is a hyper masculinized space and doesn't really leave any room for like traditionally feminine appearances. So makeup, big no-no. Yeah, everything literally melts off your face. I'm assuming you've never opened an oven with mascara on. It's the craziest feeling. Your eyelashes like curl back.
It's on my bucket list.
Similarly with hair. Everything has to be up. It's normally really greasy.
No fake nails.
Absolutely no nails.
No high heels.
No heels, unfortunately. No jewellery. One of the things I found really interesting was to do with chef's trousers, because there's so much of the professional kitchen that's designed for men.
That's something I've never seen a single skirt in a kitchen ever. Like, that's a profession that's where I've never seen a skirt.
No, yeah. I mean, it's partly safety. So chef's trousers are designed to be baggy and airy because you have that kind of insulating air air layer to keep you cool. But also, if anything splashes on you, you don't want it to touch your leg.
Yeah.
Some of them have like quick release pop studs, like stripper trousers, so that if anything happens, you can just like whip them off. We have no idea where the image of the checkered trouser is from.
Really?
Like,
but could it be from the checkered tablecloth in the early restaurant that you mentioned? But also kitchen floors are traditionally checkered tiles as well.
Yes. Yeah, some people think it might have something to do with hiding splashes, so you look a bit tidier.
Okay.
But there's another idea that it comes from the outfits of English huntsmen. So it's like a kind of well-to-do, kind of tartany...
I think it's like dazzle camouflage. It's to distract like the German naval radar.
Well, they haven't yet attacked. So.
No, it's working.
A tea towel.
Okay.
Or a side towel if you're getting chefy with it. But yeah, this is used for basically everything. So there's a food writer called Ivy Knight who wrote an article about the side towel in Food and Wine. And she says that they are pot holders that you carry things with. You wipe things clean, you dry things, you dry your hands, you mop your brow, you soak them and freeze them and wrap them around your necks when it's really, really hot. You wet them and you put them underneath chopping boards to stop the slippage.
Gotcha.
You can wrap them around things to stop them from leaking. It's just like an endlessly useful tool.
It's a bit like the towel in The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy.
Exactly like the towel in Hitchhikers. Restaurants go through so many of these every day, and they are quite expensive.
Why the laundry bills
now? The last thing, the most important thing, Sharpies.
Oh, okay.
Never be without your Sharpie.
Really?
They go missing. So literally every single thing in a kitchen is labeled, and you have FIFO, which is first in, first out. So you basically use things in order that they've been made. If you're fancy, you get specially printed labels, but mostly it's like masking tape.
Okay, so Sharpie and tea towel, you're saying are they actually... These should be a part of our cliche image of a chef.
What about front of house? Because there's one thing that I always picture with a waiter, particularly a French waiter, and that's a moustache.
Oh.
So the first decade of the 20th century... Moustaches in Europe are a symbol of the elite and the sophisticated. And in fact, at this time, all officers in the British Army had to have a moustache and the French Army.
Wow, they had to.
What if you can't grow a good moustache?
There are reports of people sticking fake moustaches on.
Oh my God.
What was interesting was restaurant culture had boomed over the late 1800s and some waiters were sporting moustaches because they thought they looked smart. But the culture around restaurants at the time was that it was replicating a big grand house. So you would go out from your big grand house and go to a separate fake big grand house.
Yeah.
So it's kind of, they were role playing as domestic servants. And domestic servants weren't allowed to have moustaches because they weren't elite enough.
Uh-huh.
So there was this kind of reckoning between waiters. Are they like lowly members of the servant class? Or are they like, because they are a bit more independent.
They're working, but they're in the upper class. And
sort of in their space.
That's so interesting. So the waiters wanted to be seen as
exactly
a kind of member of the upper class, and presumably the upper classes were like, no, no, you're our star.
Yeah, you know, you should know your place.
Wow.
So they went on strike, and it cost a lot of money to the hospitality industry. In 1907... Yeah, and like, we don't know the figures, but thousands of waiters went on strike.
Imagine striking over moustaches. That's so weird.
And I think they wanted... you know, shorter hours and more pay, as you often want when you
shorter
strike.
Shorter hours and longer moustaches.
And I actually think they conceded on the pay in order to keep the moustaches.
Oh my God, that's insane.
But there's some great quotes. So the Memorial de la Loire said, in French, but the translation was, women are quite determined to starve with their children rather than see the whiskers of their husbands still fall under the razor. which I like.
I guarantee no wife was actually saying that.
They're like, take the money! That's another good use for a Sharpie. Draw it on.
Ooh. That's true.
Anyway, so they won their argument, and then by the end of the First World War, moustaches were not quite so like fashionable, and there was
one man was about to change all that.
Charlie Chaplin.
Okay, on to our third and final course today, and that is from me, and I have brought you my bucket list of restaurants I'd like to eat at.
Ooh, great.
I have collected quite a list of unusual and distinctive restaurants out there. What do you guys have, any specific restaurants, that memorable restaurants you've been to?
The Rainforest Cafe for my 7th birthday.
Oh, yeah, that's cool. That's a classic. Nice. Yeah,
I think it still exists. Mm.
I went to like a roller coaster restaurant. Like, you're not on a roller coaster, that'd be insane. But the food comes on little. It's like there's like little roller coaster tracks all around the room, and the food rolls down.
Wait, does it go upside down? How does it?
No, I don't think so.
Why is the food always ending up on the floor? That's like Sushi Belt, but to the next level.
Yeah. Yes,
and I love a Sushi Belt restaurant. I love any restaurant that has like a train system or anything. Yes. That's really good fun. Yeah, yeah.
I actually can't think. I don't think I've been to a novelty restaurant before.
Okay, well maybe you will want to go to one of these. So the first one is El Diablo.
Okay.
Which is a restaurant in Lanzarote in Spain.
Yeah.
It's a pretty normal looking restaurant, but then they've got a sort of well that's built over a volcanic vent. So the restaurant is built close next to a volcano.
Ooh.
And the volcanic heat comes up through this hole and they grill all the food on the volcanic
heat. That's so cool.
Yeah.
Is that quite carbon neutral then? You know, you don't have to pay energy
pretty much,
bills.
Yeah, that's true. They are actually, they don't have to pay for it.
And it's called El Diablo.
I mean, it's pretty...
on the nose.
It's pretty hellish. Yeah,
I'd be
yeah.
so tempted to dress up as Lord of the Rings characters
and throw a ring in there.
Throw
an onion ring in.
Kind of the opposite of that. There are a couple under the sea that I would love to go to.
Oh.
So there's one in Norway called Under, which is, it looks really cool. It looks like, it's like a rectangular block of a building that looks like they sort of put it on the shore and then
it slipped
it,
bit,
like,
yeah.
like it's kind of fallen into the sea.
I think
so
I've seen this.
One end of it is stuck in the water. The restaurant itself is really cool. It looks like a bond lair. It's a very minimalist concrete room that's quite dimly lit.
Norway.
And then one wall of this room is just a floor-to-ceiling window that's underwater.
Okay, cool. I was worried.
They do, which
so
was really interesting.
Like, I want that one.
Yeah, maybe they just open the window really fast and grab the fish and close it again. I don't know. But what's interesting is that the building also supports marine life research.
Oh,
so I don't know what it's like to have a job as like a marine biologist trying to save the fish while like in the same building.
Excuse me. Yeah. You're just going through the tables, knocking over there.
You like CPR a fish back to life over 6 months. You're like, I finally saved an endangered species. And then next day, your colleague has cooked it because they were short. Yeah.
Don't they do this with safari? They're like, oh, we're funding the research and the conservation of these animals if we let a couple of rich people shoot a lion once
in a
while. Like,
it is a bit of like weird mental gymnastics. Yeah. There's another water themed one. It's a bit different. It's the Labasin Waterfalls restaurant in the Philippines.
Okay.
And it's an artificial waterfall, but it's a very big waterfall that the restaurant is built at the bottom of. And so the water is kind of crashing down right next to one side of it. But then the restaurant...
It's super loud. You can't hear
the... Well, it's going to be quite a struggle, yeah. It is very noisy. But then the restaurant itself is kind of on a plateau, but the water rushes over the plateau. So you have to take your shoes and socks off to dive.
Cool.
And it's all long benches, so it does look like someone flooded a Wagamama's to sort of put it outside.
That's so nice.
But yeah, that seems kind of cool. I like the idea of like having your feet washed while you eat.
Yes, it's true.
Very biblical.
Then in Finland, there is an ice restaurant.
Of course there is,
exactly. Mm-hmm. But it looks pretty amazing. But I don't know what food they serve.
No, if your plate comes up, be careful, the plate's hot and it just starts sinking through
the table. You're always sending the food back because it's too cold.
That'd be genius.
It's like going to the pound shop and being like, how much is this? Yeah. This is maybe my favourite one. I don't actually know whether I want to do this or not because it sounds insane. It's called Dinner in the Sky.
Uh-huh.
It doesn't have one.
Yes.
Have you done it?
I know I've seen people do this.
Have you seen people do this?
It was something at the O2.
Yeah.
And I think we were going to see Christina Aguilera or something.
The O2 is the kind of place where this would happen.
Yeah, yeah. And then before we went in, we saw this crane lifting this seat.
It's exactly that. So it's not in one location. It's like a travelling experience. I've got a picture here.
That's it.
It's basically, the idea is that there's a massive crane, like a really big crane that goes really high into the air, and it winches up a dining table which has seats attached to it. So you basically get strapped in around a dining table. It's kind of like that scene from Mary Poppins, but like on a much more intense scale, because you're not floating in a room, you're floating like 50 meters
above
the... What
if you need to pee? This is my only thing. Yeah. Like, there's no toilet
break.
Well,
my worry is like, what if you drop a fork? Because in a restaurant, you just pick it up, but here, you'll kill someone.
But presumably seat belted in.
I think it's kind of probably like a roller coaster. You're strapped into the seats. It's literally like a dozen people around a table, just to describe it a bit more. Mm. And all the chairs are obviously attached to the table. So you are strapped in and like attached to the table. And then I think there's a chef kind of in the middle. The middle of the table is a sunken bit, so that they've prepared some of the food, but they do also sort of cook some of it up there on an open flame. Wow. And so the chef's in the middle giving you this three-course meal.
Your nearest fire escape is just fall off.
It can last up to 90 minutes, depending on the event. I mean, it is just a chain that's holding you up there, so it's going to be very windy and swingy and, like, you know, not fun. I think that's crazy. I think humans need to stop and chill. And
So you wouldn't.
So that's kind of it's on my list. It's right at the bottom of the list, because I'm like, if I've really got nothing else to do, then maybe it's fine.
The biggest restaurant in the world.
Yeah,
it's in Syria.
Ooh.
It's called Damascus Gate. And it can serve 6,014 people.
Wow.
Which I looked it up. It's bigger than the home stadium of Boston United.
Wow. Uh-huh.
Or Bromley, to name it.
Wait, just all of
League 2 club. Wow. No, Bromley.
6,014 is quite a weird number. I know. Maybe squeezed in a couple more tables there.
It's 54,000 metres squared. But they've basically got sections. They employ 1,800 people.
Whoa.
And they've got waterfalls, replicas of Syrian archaeological artifacts.
Wow.
And
if I worked in front of house, I'd have so much fun when people turn up being like, oh, I don't know if we can squeeze you in, and it's just like empty. Like, there's a lot of bookings tonight. And then then I would seat them right by the toilets, even though it's like hundreds of miles of empty tables.
50,000 square feet is going to pick this one.
The waiter's coming all the way over from the kitchen.
You can see him from miles away, just like jogging over.
Yeah, God, imagine trying to catch their eye over a
Excuse me.
So another one, we've mentioned this before, I think, Dans le Noir. In London, this is a restaurant. So it's like it's literally just a restaurant, but it's pitch black, and they turn the lights off.
Wasn't this the one Rosie was shitting on?
Well, she was like, it's a bit of a gimmick, and it's a bit silly. And
it is a gimmick, but I back it.
It's a fun, again, it's a gimmick that I would try once for the fun of it, although I do think the novelty would wear out after 5 minutes. I think halfway through I'd be like, I actually can't, I don't know what I'm eating here. But apparently it's staffed by visually impaired people.
You could
and
do
it's
that.
Integral to the plot. It's the meet cute of About Time, isn't it?
Yes,
that's
it is.
What I'm thinking.
Yeah.
It's so
that was a good idea. Yeah, this is a weird one. The new Lucky restaurant in India, in Ahmedabad, which is right next to the Sidi Said Mosque. Okay. This very famous historic mosque. And it started off as a kind of tea cart by the cemetery that was there, this very old Muslim cemetery. And it's now grown into it's open-fronted vegetarian cafe, but it's like a proper building. But they've built it on top and around the burial ground. So I have a picture here, look. So there's literally tables with people eating, and then there are graves and kind of coffins on the ground with little fences around
them.
What
kind of cemetery? Is this a Muslim cemetery?
Yeah.
That's, wow, I didn't, because you're not supposed to go anywhere near the top of a grave. Like, walking over a grave in Muslim culture is like,
Well, I don't think you'd walk over them. And I think that the staff clean the graves, like, every morning and kind of tend to put flowers on. So it's kind of maintaining the cemetery, I guess, which it might otherwise not be. I'm not sure.
Mosques often have good kitchens. I remember in Edinburgh when I was working the Fringe, just flyering. We'd go to the mosque kitchen.
Oh, really?
They did such good food and really cheap. Yeah,
that's good. A good catch. Then maybe my favourite. There's a lavatory-themed restaurant in Taiwan called Modern Toilet Restaurant.
I've seen this one. This is so
good. That's so funny. Presumably you sit on a toilet.
I mean, it's like something out of AI. So you sit on a toilet. The tables are sinks. Your drinks come in like urinal-shaped cups. The whole thing actually evolved out of an ice cream parlor where they did like soft serve chocolate ice cream that looked like poo, and so they still serve that.
Is it successful?
I think it was actually a bit of a franchise for a while, and I think now there's only one restaurant left, but it was very popular. Is it less so now? But I think this one in Taiwan is still open.
Wow. So. Would you guys go
again? I would have a look. I don't know whether I'd like drop £60 in a meal there.
Do you go to the toilet and it's just tables with tablecloths?
can't
shit anywhere.
Yeah, the risk of somebody going to the toilet in the wrong toilet. So
stressful.
I'm going to finish on a couple that actually you can't go to anymore because they've closed down, sadly. A friend of the podcast, the Heart Attack Grill, has closed last May, only a month or so ago. So to remind everyone, this was this hospital-themed restaurant in Las Vegas,
yes,
where they like all. I think you can go there dressed in like gowns, and the servers are dressed as nurses, and they just serve these unbelievably unhealthy burgers called like the triple bypass.
Didn't they sell cigarettes as well?
That's the only vegan thing on the menu.
They've had to close it after 15 years.
For what reason? Just no one's coming in anymore.
Everyone's dead.
The only
you only go once.
I'm going to finish on the Twins restaurant on 2nd Avenue in the Upper East Side.
Okay.
It was opened in 1994 by twin sisters Debbie and Lisa Gans. It was staffed by more than 30 sets of identical twins. So they like ran everything, and like the whole concept was just like, we're twins. They all had to work like on the same shift, so that you could only work there if your sibling was there. Also, if one twin called in sick, the other had to stay at home as well, because like the whole point is that you're both there.
That's true.
If one was fired, the other one got fired.
Imagine ordering with one and then trying to flag someone and then
did you not get my order? Yeah, I think there must have been so much confusion.
Yeah, it sounds like the gimmick isn't really work. That's the wrong setting for it.
It had to close in 2000s, but the twin database that they built up ended up being the start of their talent business. So they now run a twin talent business. So
I thought you were
going
to say it's, you know, all of the twin studies that scientists like to run, like in space and blah, blah, blah. I thought you were going to say
That would be the effective way of using them, is that you split them up so that one twin is in the kitchen and one twin is waiting, and you use their telepathic powers to get the orders in really fast.
Genius.
Okay, that's it for this week's edition of Lunchbox MV.
You can follow our socials for foodie facts and podcast updates. We are on YouTube, Facebook, Instagram, and TikTok at Lunchbox MV Pod.
You can also get in touch and send us your facts, recipes, questions, or suggestions for future topics by emailing us lunchbox@qi.com.
And we will see you next week. Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Bye.
Lunchbox MV was hosted by Jack Chambers, Manu Onrio, and produced by me, Alex Bell. This has been a quite interesting podcast. Have we got anything on tipping?
We do.
Well, in the interest of tipping your
staff. Should we give you 12.5% more content? Yeah.
Tipping is thought to have started in England, which I was surprised with, because we don't have a tipping culture anymore. And it was when guests would go and stay at someone's house, you'd leave some money for their servants as a like, thank you for looking after me. Again, really fudgy etymology. We think it might come from an old word for to give, to handle, to pass. Like I said, tipping culture is really different all over the world. In the UK, we're not very good at tipping. In the US, they love tipping. Apparently, they imported it from Europe because wealthy Americans thought it made them look fancier and more European. But yeah,
didn't work, guys.
But there's actually basically like a scientist of tipping from Cornell University called Michael Lynn. And he's done like loads and loads of studies on tipping. And he actually wrote a guide that we mentioned in QI really briefly on for waitstaff on how to boost your tips.
We're crazy.
And it's, you know what, it's a legit study. So it's called Mega Tips, Scientifically Tested Techniques to Increase Your Tips, that he published in 2003. It's basically a review of lots of other studies of waitstaff and how to boost your tips. So he advises wearing like a crazy hairpin or a funky button or something because customers love the like quirky
Customers will feel sorry for you because you look shit.
Here's some money to buy some new clothes.
He says, do not wear offensive iconography if you do this one.
Fair enough.
I mean, yeah, okay.
That's just how to get on in life.
Sure, that's how not to get fired from your job.
This is true. There's another one that he calls postural congruence. So basically, as a
rubbing yourself up against them.
Yeah, like really? Physically as close as you possibly can to your customer, if you can.
Get your
face close to their face.
Is that just to threaten them?
No, friendly. Yeah. Pull up a chair at the table whilst you're taking their order.
It really annoys me when they do that.
I've never seen
I'm
it.
Like,
but
don't
I'm like,
settle
don't...
in. This isn't going to take very long.
Is this specifically in America? Because I feel like Brits would react very differently to all this.
Hate it. And then there's something he calls touch manipulation. Touching customers.
Like under the table.
It's just like people, apparently, according to another study he reviewed, like being touched on very kind of neutral bits of the body.
Okay, like a shoulder.
Yeah, yeah, so like if you're asking someone a question or you're taking their order, you can like touch their shoulder.
It's not like when they hand over the card and then you just like...
the brushes.
But yeah, apparently
it's risky. It's very risky, that.
That boosts your tips by 12%. Wow. You get in touch with customers.
I think it depends whether you're like a man or a woman.
And that is very true.
I reckon they were quite sexy women.
That is it for this episode of Lunchbox Envy. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.